Welcome to another edition of In the Reading Corner. Today I have Lucy Strange returning for another conversation, and we're going to be talking about The Island at the Edge of Night. It's no secret I'm a great fan of Lucy's writing, and I have to say that I read it in one sitting. It's a page turner. I would describe it as an ecological mystery with a historical setting and an overall feeling of gothic. Yeah. How would you describe it?
There are lots of ingredients in there, aren't there? There is the gothic feel that I love so much, Nikki, that it seems to creep into all my writing, whether I'm thinking about it or not. There's the feeling of the gothic about it, that sense of dark mysteries, of things lurking in shadowy corners, and that sense of uncertainty that I think can be such a hook in a story, because we want to know the truth. We want to know what's really going on. And then, yes, there are ideas in there to do with nature and to do with our relationship with nature and our relationship with each other. I suppose the idea of only connect, no man is an island, the John Donne way of looking at it, that there's a human need to connect to each other, and I believe to connect with nature as well. What were the other ingredients you mentioned?
Historical aspect. It wasn't until partway through the book when I actually realised when this set, I was getting Victorian vibes, but it's a bit later than that.
Yeah, it's a little bit later. Although I think, unlike some of my other stories, so unlike our Castle by the Sea, for example, in which the history is a very important part of the plot, it's not so much in this one. It's really just to do with the setting. It's to do with the atmosphere more than anything else. One of the reasons I like to set my stories in the past is to do with the feel of it, because I like to create that classic feeling to a story, as if we're discovering a story that was written a while ago. But it also, from a plot perspective, helps with the tension, with creating vulnerability for your characters, because we don't have the technology that's there to potentially to get us out of all sorts of pickles.
You talked about hooks, and you've created a great hook for us, because there's a prologue and that launches us straight into the mystery. If you've got a book to hand, would you read it for us?
I'd love to read the prologue. It's because it's quite short, isn't it? So I think it is a nice way in. Our main character in The Island at the Edge of Night is Faye Fitzgerald, and Faye has been sent away to a sinister boarding school on a remote Scottish island. And Faye is told by the rather unpleasant people who run the school that she, along with the other children who are there, that they've all been sent there because they have done something wicked. And Faye cannot remember what it is she's supposed to have done. So her memory has blanked out everything that happened on that terrible night, and she can only remember a few fragments of what happened. So I'm going to read the prologue now. The house was all in darkness, and the storm was still raging outside, just as it had been when I'd gone to bed a few hours before. But I wasn't in my bed now. I was standing at the top of the stairs with no memory of how I had got there. Had I been sleepwalking? I was in my nightdress, and the floorboards were cold as glass beneath my bare feet. Aunt Christina? Father? I called. But there was no reply. Lightning flashed, sudden and blinding white. I gripped the banister to steady my heart. Thunder crashed above the city, and rain hammered on the roof and windows, pounding a pulse in my brain, frightened and furious. Was it the storm that had woken me? Or was it something else? I made my way down the stairs and out of the kitchen door into the walled garden. I remember the wind and rain striking hard, making me gasp, fallen leaves slimed wet between my toes, and my nightdress clung heavy and cold. I remember going past Father's collection of plants, all battered and cowering. I remember crawling through the hole in the broken fence into the graveyard. I remember seeing the old yew tree, a ragged silhouette against the stormlit sky. And then the memory shatters like a mirror. All I have are a handful of splinters, flashes of that night that come and go like lightning. A metal blade gleaming wet. A hacking, splitting sound that makes me go cold inside. A scream so piercing it still buzzes deep in my bones. After that night, there was nothing. Just weeks of stifling dark. The city rain relentless on my bedroom window. Day-long dreams left me shaking with terror, those dark shards of memory, and the faintest echo of a voice murmuring in horror. What have you done, Faye? Oh, what have you done, you wicked child?
I defy anybody not to be hooked by that prologue. And of course, the rest of the story is a gradual unraveling of that mystery as Faye's memory has to return to her and this situation has to be resolved. Well, maybe we ought to start with Faye herself and the kind of character she is. Let's start there.
She is a character who has been isolated. So she had this rather idyllic sort of childhood in the forest with her father that was suddenly, abruptly cut off. She and her father suddenly, for a reason she does not understand at this point, they went to go and live with her aunt Christina in the city. And having grown up surrounded by the trees, she is suddenly in this rather bleak urban environment. And the yew tree in the graveyard becomes her only sanctuary. She is sent off to boarding school after boarding school. And she stops talking to people. She finds it harder and harder to communicate. And she becomes more and more of an island, more and more cut off. And once they're living in the city, she hardly sees her father anymore either. Again, for reasons she doesn't understand. He shuts himself away from her. She describes him as being like a closed door. And what happens when she's told she's done this terrible thing is she loses faith in herself, that she doesn't trust herself anymore, and she feels she doesn't know or even understand herself anymore. That was something I was really interested in exploring, that trusting ourselves and trusting our instincts and trusting that there are wonderful things inside us. It's something that can be very hard, I think, particularly when there are so many external influences around us and the pushing and pulling of everything, of family, of society, of social media, pulling us in all sorts of directions. And I think finding that courage to trust ourselves and to know ourselves and have faith in ourselves is possibly harder than ever. And so that's at the heart of the story. And courage and finding the strength to stand up to things when you know they feel wrong. That sense of powerlessness creeps up in a lot of my stories.
She doesn't have to fight alone, and we'll come to the ensemble of characters in a little while. But before we do that, it probably won't have escaped listeners that you've used the word island. You've referenced John Donne there, and you've talked about Faye feeling that she's an island, that she's cut off. And your story has island in the title as well. So it's working at lots of different levels in the story, this idea of being cut off and being an island. She's sent away by her aunt and father to a boarding school on a Scottish island, and it's just about as awful as it could be. In fact, it used to be a monastery, and their bedrooms are the monks' cells. But there she meets another girl called, wonderful name, Boudica Braithwaite. And I think where Faye is quietly subversive, Boudica is loud and full of daring and courage. So these two characters work really well together. Maybe tell us a bit about their friendship.
So Boudica was one of these characters who just appeared in my head fully formed. And it happens from time to time. Often we have to work at characters and develop them and tweak them and change things about them. But Boudica just arrived and she was in the story and she is loud and she says things and she doesn't care. You're absolutely right. She is the opposite of Faye in so many ways. She's physically bigger. Faye's much smaller physically. And she feels like a small person, if that makes sense. And Boudica is large physically and in terms of her character. And through this, the beginnings of a friendship, and it's through this really that Faye starts to have a little more courage, a little more belief in herself. Trees are important in the story, or in fact, the lack of trees. I've done a lot of reading about trees and the connections between trees below the ground, the hidden life of trees, and finding the mother tree, all these wonderful books that have come out in recent years, to do with us discovering that how trees live in families, how they communicate with each other. It's just so magical, so extraordinary. And I was fascinated with that idea of roots reaching out to each other in the darkness. And that's essentially what happens with the friendships in this story too. We find these roots in the darkness of this terrible, terrible situation, this terrible place that they're in, and the roots of these children reaching out to each other and finding each other in the dark.
There's an image where Boudica has been sent basically to solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And she digs a hole so that she can communicate and so that food and reading material can be passed between them. And that is almost underground, the roots reaching across.
Yes, that is. That's exactly the moment when these connections start to become really meaningful for Faye.
You did preempt my next question. Part one starts with some text that comes from a book or a pamphlet that's been written. And it's very much like the Hidden Life of Trees. If only we'd known that it had been written in the 1930s.
I have taken some liberties chronologically here because these sorts of discoveries are much more recent. But I was interested in that idea of what if. So many stories start with a what if, don't they, Nikki? What if a scientist had stumbled upon this in a different era, scientifically speaking, nearly 100 years ago? And if they were putting forward these theories that trees talk to each other, trees can communicate. And what would have happened from that? Such theories might well have been seen as being unscientific and fantastical and almost childish.
Faye has the real natural affinity with nature, and her name itself suggests Faye, fairy. It kind of has that feeling to it. Is there anything we can say about that?
There's the idea of these kind of spirits, I suppose, these magical spirits of nature, which are there in the folklore of so many cultures, going back hundreds, thousands of years. This idea of sonification, if you like, of the spirit of nature. We have tree nymphs, we have water spirits. And Scottish folklore has so many wonderful, weird and wicked fairy creatures, the Shee, some of which are helpful and some of which are, I was doing a lot of rummaging around and all of this. Folklore, I find, is such a rich source to get ideas from. So some of these ideas are woven into the story. And you're absolutely right, Faye's name, although it's spelled F-A-Y-E rather than F-A-E, but the idea of the Faye, the idea of, and that ambiguity that I love playing with so much. It's part of the gothic genre, isn't it, really?
Was the folklore the reason that you decided to set it in Scotland, or is it just the geography is perfect for this story?
Retrospectively, it's really hard to remember what came first and how the different layers of the story kind of materialised. I knew I wanted to write an island story. When I go into schools, we talk about why islands are such great settings for stories. And the children come up with the most brilliant, brilliant ideas. And islands they're fantastic settings for stories. So I knew I wanted to write an island story. And I went with my family to the Isle of Skye when I was a child. And we went back more recently, my husband and I and our little boy, and spent some time there. I felt so inspired by the sort of the wild beauty and the rugged beauty, and there's a bleakness to it in places as well. The mountains of Coolin are awe-inspiring. And you have these beautiful fairy pools, and then you have the weirdness of the Quirang up in the north of the island. The story's not set on Skye, but it is very much inspired by the Isle of Skye. And there are little bits of St Kilda's as well. It's uninhabited now and a very important place for wildlife, for birds, for seabirds. I'm also fascinated in these places that are no longer inhabited, that were once inhabited, and these abandoned dwellings, these abandoned cottages. Again, there's some elements of history there to do with the clearances and forests being cut down and people being turfed out of their homes in order to make more space for grazing. That's all there as well. I've got a theory about stories, perhaps particularly children's stories, that a few weeks, a few months, a few years down the line, we won't remember the plots. We never remember all the stuff that happened in a story. But I think we always remember how we felt reading it. And so I think the tone, the atmosphere of a story and the setting itself are so, so important in creating that really magical, immersive experience for a reader.
One of the symbols of what's happening between humans and nature is the great auk that appears through the story. What's special about the Great Auk?
There's a connection with the Scottish Islands and the last places in which Great Auks were seen before they became extinct, before the last ones were hunted to extinction. This idea of hunting is in there as well. And again, without wanting to give too much away, but the idea of something vulnerable being hunted down.
One step ahead of me all the time. The villains are next. The villains.
Well, I'll introduce villains by talking about the Great Auk, because for the villains in the story, the Great Auk is a symbol of hunt or be hunted, that in order to succeed, we must be predatory. That's how they see it.
So the two villains on the island, Dr. Lighter and his wife, Nurse Violet.
Yes.
Or Violent. Her description, I just loved it. A blade so sharp you can hardly feel it. That kind of Mrs. Coulter vibe, that softness.
Yeah, that's
so sharp underneath.
Yeah. She's someone who's glamorous. She's always wearing pink lipstick and expensive leather gloves. She's a hunter as well. She wears her sort of hunting tweeds and takes her shotgun out with them when they go for their compulsory daily exercise and so on. But she has this kind of sugary sweetness and an apparent attractiveness in terms of her superficial mm-hmm. appearance and her charming manner that she can turn on and off like a tap. But beneath it, this very real sense of threat. And then Dr. Leiter himself, who's the headmaster, well, he's sort of a chief jailer in a way, because these children are here to be contained. But he is also interested in reforming them at first. He's interested in reforming them and toying with hypnosis and dabbling in amateur psychology, when of course he has no real understanding of any of these things and doesn't genuinely care.
As you were describing Nurse Violet there, of course, one of the things that comes up is that appearances can be deceptive. Mm. And that's equally true of some of the children on the island. Maybe we can just talk about one of them, Lord Gordon.
I suppose it's to do with the idea that the children have been pitted against each other. And one of the first things Nurse Violet does is she locks Boudicca in her room when Faye and Boudicca arrive at the school. And Faye is shocked witnessing this. This is the first time she realizes that they are essentially prisoners on the island. And Nurse Violet says that it's to keep them safe from each other. And that stays with Faye. It's divide and conquer, isn't it? Really, that's the approach that the Leiters have taken. They want to make the children afraid of each other. And they encourage the children to see each other's as monstrous. And Lord Gordon is the one who is seen by all of them as being genuinely terrifying. He's this huge, tall, white, blonde, completely silent character. He just sits there and observes everything. And what they are told is that he has shot his own brother, and that's why he's been sent to this island.
Perhaps we can move on and talk a little bit about your writing process. And you mentioned setting being really important to you. I know it's hard sometimes after the fact to think about how all those layers fit together. Mm. But what things are you conscious of in terms of your writing process?
So I think very often starting with settings, the character with a strong emotional hook. So these are usually some of the earliest ingredients in the story. And then the other things come in layers of research, layers of daydreaming. I think my stories often take a long time to simmer away and while I discover what is going to be most useful, most interesting, most powerful for the story. One of the things that I always do in the early stages of developing stories, I create mood boards. We rush into writing a story too soon. I think that's the temptation. We've got an idea and we want to get it down on paper. So I create these collages of images, but I'm also thinking about it in an artistic way. I think about tone. I think about the colours that are going to be important in the story. My mood board for The Island at the Edge of Night has glorious, rich colours from the northern lights in the sky and all the colours of the Scottish moorland. That the artist Katie Hickey has depicted so beautifully, so richly in her gorgeous, gorgeous cover design. And then compare that to my mood board, the Ghost of Goswater, which is wintry, all snow and ice and mist and a ram's skull and a white opal and so on. And the feeling, the colours, I think are really important. I do sometimes work from photographs of places, but I find actually working from paintings of places is much more interesting, because then you have a layer of artistic interpretation. Quite often I end up translating artworks into particular settings, particular landscapes in my stories.
The idea of sharpness and cutting was very much running through this story. I read that quote, the introduction of Nurse Violet. There are things to do with diamonds and the hard edgedness of things. And there's quite a lot of that sharp tools in this.
And the blade.
Story.
Yeah, there is. I love playing with these sort of literary motifs. I can enjoy the story as this kind of thrilling gothic adventure on an island with a mystery to be discovered. What I aim for is that it can also be enjoyed on that more literary level as well. And you can unpick it and you can look at these themes, these motifs that are embroidered through the story as well.
Do you go back and rework a lot of that?
Yeah. This book was a long time in the process, actually. It's my usual process would be a full first draft and then one big rewrite and then a slightly tighter rewrite and then line edits, but this one had a couple of big overhauls. It took a longer time for it to really find itself, this story. When I started writing this story, my dad died very suddenly. I actually found that for a while, this wasn't how I expected grief to manifest itself, Nikki, but for a while, all I wanted to write was comedy. I wanted to write something really light and silly. So I ended up writing something completely different for a while and then came back to the island at the edge of night when I was ready to do so.
You've talked about the slow process of writing and a build-up. You were also a teacher, and I wondered how you match what writing needs and its processes and the demands of the classroom.
I think children's writing is such an interesting thing and such an important thing, and that children should feel motivated to write and excited to write. And this is something that I was passionate about as a teacher and I am passionate about now. And so much of it is actually nothing to do with the writing process itself. That's just the getting there. What we need to feel is it is motivated enough to do it. That's what's important for writers at any level, whether you're a 10-year-old writing in a classroom or whether you're an adult writing a book to be published. When I'm talking in schools as well, is the process and the rewriting and the editing, which a lot of young people find very frustrating and very, very difficult to do. I think it can be really encouraging when they hear the extent to which children's authors have to rewrite and edit and come back to a story again and again, and how hard it is to do that, because it's really hard to take feedback. I talk about the fact that when I get my emails from my editor that I feel just the same as they do when they get lots and lots of red pen at the end of something they've written. But how important it is, I think, to bounce back from that initial feeling. If I can find that resilience, if I can find that courage to go back in one more time and change this bit and make that bit even better, then actually I'm going to end up with something really, really special, something really shining and glittering and really something I can truly be proud of.
When you work with an editor, there's that mutual respect. And they help you shape your story, but they don't change your story. With children, it's important we don't edit their voice out.
Yes, you're quite right, for them to discover the voice that they need to use. And it can be so hard. They're being pushed and pulled in so many directions, teachers meeting requirements of various different things and curriculum and SATs. But I completely agree with you. We want children to choose to write as well. I call it recreational writing. We have reading for pleasure, don't we? And I call it recreational writing, to choose to write. I think very few children will choose to write for the sake of the physical act of writing, allowing them to find the stories they want to tell and they feel excited to tell.
I feel that I could talk to you all day. And what's really obvious to anybody listening is how passionately you feel about this. And I can only imagine that you must have been an amazing teacher of both reading and writing. The great news is that, of course, you get the chance to visit schools and for that little bit of magic to rub off on lots of different classes. So I would like it if you could tell us a bit about what can teachers expect from you when you go and work with children, and how can they get hold of you?
I do lots of different things. All my events are done through speaking of books. So I do lots of different things. I do author talks about my books and about particular books. I talk about my stories, about how the stories evolve and how we can get inspiration and ideas for stories. But I talk a bit about reading in general as well. And we do a bit of virtual book shopping, and we talk about finding a genre or finding an author who's your cup of tea and how wonderful that is. We create our own ideas for stories. I often say you don't need one good idea to start writing a story. You need two good ideas. Because when you've got two good ideas, they can spark against each other. And that's when you get something really exciting and interesting happening. So we combine different ingredients and we play with different genres and we see what emerges. And I do my mood boards that I mentioned before. And I also now do some inset for teachers as well. I talk about how we can build that reading for pleasure culture in a school, how we can really build that buzz around reading and inspiring that intrinsic motivation. I get to have all these lovely things of being a teacher that I miss so much from my 15 years I was an English teacher. And I come back to my writing shed.
That's fabulous. Lucy, I don't think it's going to be the last time we talk to you. Keep writing those fantastic books, both for Chicken House, your longer novels, and the wonderful novellas that you've written for Barrington Stoke as well. And hopefully we're going to have the chance to talk to you about those in the autumn term. Thank you so much for taking your time to chat with us in the Reading Corner today.
Thank you for having me.